Over the weekend, Illinois surged past 11,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19. Governor J.B. Pritzker says he thinks most people are doing the right thing, staying at home, but not everybody.
And all I can say is that those people either are not paying attention to the news or they're stupid.
Pritzker also says Illinois will need more ventilators to prepare for a worst-case scenario. We'll speak with an Illinois engineer whose team created a device meant to help. And with gyms closed and people looking for stress relief, some are taking up running. We'll get tips from Illinois experts and hear about their Olympic dreams being put on hold. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, and WNIJ in DeKalb. That's coming up this hour on the 21st. But first, the news. This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, and this is Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker.
Thank you to the people of Illinois who are taking this seriously, and that really is almost all of you. Some people aren't. We saw that, you know, on the lakefront in Chicago. We saw that in some parks in downstate areas of Illinois. And all I can say is that those people either are not paying attention to the news or they're stupid. That's all I can say. I mean, there's no reason why somebody should be ignoring this. You could be giving it to your own family, and you could get it yourself.
That was from the governor's daily COVID briefing on Saturday afternoon. In the last few days, Pritzker also encouraged Illinoisans to wear masks when out in public. And by Sunday afternoon, he and members of his administration were setting an example.
Governor Pritzker wore a mask as he walked to the podium for this afternoon's briefing. He says,
meanwhile, musicians were raising money online for the new Arts for Illinois Relief Fund. The music here is from a live webcast by Chicago-based Third Coast Percussion. And all the while, the coronavirus continues its spread across the state. About the latest developments with COVID-19 in Illinois is Mary Hansen. She's a reporter for member station WUIS, NPR Illinois, and joins us from Springfield. Mary, how are you?
I'm doing all right, thanks. How are you?
You know, getting by, I guess, at this unusual time, but staying well, so I can't complain. Hope it's the same for you. It's hard to believe. I was looking back through my files just 3 weeks ago, March 16th, is the day many schools in Illinois closed, that the state announced 12 new confirmed cases of COVID-19 that day. It pushed the statewide total past 100 confirmed cases for the first time. And as we go to air Monday morning now, 3 weeks later, where are we, Mary?
We are quite a bit past that. We are, state officials announced yesterday that there's a total of more than 11,000 confirmed cases across the state. Just between Saturday and Sunday, there were nearly 900 new COVID-19 cases. And that includes a total of 274 deaths, unfortunately. So we're just seeing a huge increase in the number of cases.
Now, I know we're always careful when we talk about these numbers to mention confirmed or diagnosed cases, because with testing as limited as it's been, there are likely a lot of undiagnosed cases out there. I mean, is that still your understanding of what's happening?
Yes, from what I'm hearing from, we've heard from the governor and the director of the Illinois Department of Public Health continue to discuss in their daily briefings the lack of testing that's available. And here in Sangamon County, I talked with the director of the Department of Public Health last week, who said, you know, they still don't have enough tests to get a representative sample in the community. Right now, it's really focused on high risk populations, you know, those in the hospital, those in nursing homes, other congregate settings. Private testing does expand that a little bit. They are able to, you know, test people who are you know, high risk or first responders or folks like that, but it's still not enough to really get a representative sample. So the head of the Sangamon County Department of Public Health basically said, we're assuming that it's out there, and so please take the proper precautions.
You know, our partner station WGLT in Bloomington Normal had a story in the last couple of days about criteria being loosened there at a drive-up testing site. Can you tell us what was happening there?
Yeah, so that's a testing site that the Illinois National Guard, I believe, is helping to run. It looks like the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services is involved as well. And they, you know, we're testing, you know, similar to you know, the criteria that I described, you know, those in high risk settings, you know, over 65, healthcare workers, first responders. And then they recently opened it up to, you know, infrastructure workers who are showing symptoms, anybody who's showing symptoms, you know, fever, cough, those types of things. And then people even with mild symptoms. So it seems like maybe, you know, in areas where those showing mild symptoms in areas where there are a lot of cases. So that could potentially give a better idea of the spread.
So now experts have said the real number to watch here, while testing is still limited, is deaths, or at least the rate at which deaths increase, I guess, because that's a number that's not as susceptible to, what would you say, deflation on account of the lack of testing. So you mentioned 274 deaths as of Sunday afternoon. And I wonder, WBEZ had a story as well about that, based on their analysis of deaths in Chicago and Cook County, that a disproportionate share of them were among African Americans. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so what they found, they looked at the deaths among African Americans and found that 70% of the deaths in Chicago were among Black residents, even though they make up just 29% of the city's population. So so that's a staggering proportion there. And I know that the IDPH director addressed this a little bit on Saturday. She said that, you know, there's still a lot of uncertainty of what this means, you know, and talked about, you know, she's not surprised that it's affecting this vulnerable population. People who often don't have access to healthcare, you know, might have, you know, higher rates of some of those underlying conditions that make them particularly susceptible to severe cases.
Like asthma and diabetes, things like that. Yeah. So Mary, the governor's really pushing the idea of wearing masks. I think we heard at the top of the segment that he actually showed up to his Sunday briefing wearing a mask, as did Director Ezeke and other people. Can you tell us what exactly are the recommendations for those of us, at least who are not working in healthcare settings and maybe are, you know, mostly staying at home, but, you know, still going to the grocery store as needed?
Yeah, so these guidelines changed last week, and the governor, even before this on Friday, was encouraging people to start to wear masks out in public, and not just to protect yourself, but really to protect others. If you're not symptomatic, if you're, you know, you can still spread the virus if you have it. So he recommended, you know, not necessarily those N95. We don't need to be walking around like that. We need to save those for the healthcare workers and the first responders. But, you know, a paper mask or a homemade mask will do, just to, you know, reduce spreading those droplets, you know, if you're coughing or anything like that. So those are the current recommendations if you're going out, you know, to the grocery store or to the pharmacy to wear those masks.
And the last thing I want to ask you about is the governor on, I believe it was on Friday, also announced that the former, is it Vibra Hospital in Springfield, would become one of Illinois' field hospitals for COVID cases. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so the Vibra Hospital closed last year. It's a 50-bed facility, and they announced on Friday that would be the first field hospital outside of the Chicago region. So there's four up in Chicago, including McCormick Place, and then you know, Chicago and the suburbs up there. And this would be the first one downstate. So it when I talked to the Illinois Emergency Management Agency about it, you know, they said it's really a quote unquote turnkey situation where it's already you know, unlike McCormick Place, it's already a hospital, a healthcare facility. So it's sort of easy to change into you know, these field hospitals to treat patients with mild symptoms. You know, they don't necessarily need the ICU care, but still need to be hospitalized and monitored by doctors and nurses. So that's what that facility is going to look like.
Should we read into this that they're anticipating a surge of cases in Springfield?
I did ask that question to the Emergency Management Agency, and the spokesperson said, no, they're just getting ready, you know, all across the state looking for these facilities. And this one in Springfield, actually the city of Springfield had looked at purchasing it a couple of weeks ago. The mayor had already been in negotiations with the owner there. So they said this was an easy facility to bring on board for this. So.
Mary Hansen is a reporter at member station WUIS, NPR, Illinois, in Springfield. Mary, always good to talk to you. Stay well.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Governor J.B. Pritzker said yesterday on CNN's State of the Union that Illinois requested 4,000 ventilators from the federal government, but that is only a fraction of what the state will get.
So our guess is at this point that we need a few thousand more than we have now, up to 4,000. That's what we've asked the federal government for. And over time, they've given us 450 total. Now, we're looking everywhere and anywhere across the world to get ventilators.
But like Governor Pritzker, many states are worried that in a worst-case scenario, there would not be enough ventilators for COVID-19 patients who need them. Our next guest is working with a research team on one potential solution to address the shortage with a device called the Rapid Vent. Bill King is a University of Illinois professor at the Granger College of Engineering and also in the Department of Biomedical and Translational Biosciences at Carl Illinois College of Medicine. He joins us now to tell us more about the Rapid Vent and how he hopes it can help. Bill, thanks for coming on the show.
Good morning. Thank you so much for inviting me.
So, Professor King, can you describe for us the Rapid Vent and how this prototype is different from a traditional ventilator?
We have been working on developing an emergency ventilator. An emergency ventilator is a simple device. It is powered by the oxygen supply available in a regular hospital room. It connects into the hospital oxygen supply and then also connects to a patient through a regular endotracheal tube or through a mask, and it helps the patient to breathe. This is a relatively simple device, and we chose a simple product architecture as something that could potentially be scaled up very quickly to meet the needs in the coming weeks and months.
How does this differ from a traditional ventilator? You mentioned it's hooked up. If anyone's been in a hospital room, you know that on the wall behind the patient's bed, there's usually that whole array of plugs and things, and there is usually that green oxygen valve. How does this differ from what a traditional ventilator requires to operate?
So regular hospital-grade ventilators have sophisticated electronics and sensors, software intelligence that control the patient's breathing rate and volume levels for air flowing in and out of the patient, things of that nature. An emergency ventilator is something that you might turn to in a situation where a regular hospital-grade ventilator is not available. An emergency ventilator is a much simpler device. It doesn't have electronics. It doesn't have software. It's powered by air power. It's a totally mechanical device. It's relatively small. It weighs just a few pounds. And what it does is it just provides an opportunity to provide mechanical ventilation to a patient when a regular hospital ventilator is not available.
So I understand that you and your team kind of dropped everything to work on this. I'm picturing, if people remember that movie, Apollo 13, where there's that scene where they dump all these random parts on a table and say, okay, we gotta bring them back with, and this is all we have. I mean, can you describe for me the scenario and what it was like, how this idea came about, how your team went about this process?
About 3 weeks ago, Carl Health, our local hospital system, contacted the University of Illinois about the potential need for additional ventilators that may arise in the coming weeks and months, and asked us if we could lean in to do something to help. We gathered a team of about 40 people, engineers and physicians, working together to come up with a solution that would make sense in the current emergency situation. This group of people, they just dropped everything that they were doing, and we worked around the clock for about 3 weeks to make this work. It's absolutely like we've been living in the Apollo 13 movie. A big group of people really focused on solving a common problem.
And so what is the process for actually getting these things into use? Are there going to be federal regulators weighing in on this? What is the timeline here? Or can we see these things deployed pretty quickly?
We have made the technology available under a free license. So organizations can come to our website and get access to the technology for free. We are talking to a bunch of manufacturers about potentially scaling up manufacturing. Because we focused on a simple device, we believe that it would be possible to scale up manufacturing within a period of weeks. We really want to get something out here that could be helpful to the world.
And are there any downsides to this type of ventilator as opposed to the, you mentioned the hospital grade ventilators often have sophisticated electronics. What are any potential downsides for this technology?
Of course, one would always want to have the hospital grade ventilator. We understand that there may be a shortage of such ventilators in the coming weeks and months. Of course, we can see things that are playing out in other communities and other parts of the world where that very situation is occurring. So an emergency ventilator is potentially something that could fill the gap. If there's a need, these emergency ventilators could be deployed to help people who need it.
And I just want to be clear here. Is this something that would need FDA approval before it could be put into use?
Absolutely. So any medical device requires FDA approval before it could be used in a clinical application.
Okay. And just about 30 seconds left in our conversation here, but you know, I'm imagining that engineering, in a university, it can be kind of abstract sometimes, or at least there's long timelines to see things in the real world. And I wonder what it's like for you to be working on something that is such an urgent global need right now.
It is great that we can be part of helping people and solve the problem that we see playing out around us.
Okay. Bill King is professor at the Granger College of Engineering and the Carl Illinois College of Medicine's Department of Biomedical and Translational Biosciences. Good luck with the product. I hope it works out. And thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us about it.
Thank you very much.
Coming up after the break, a new survey finds surprising agreement across partisan lines about the best path forward from the coronavirus. Stay tuned. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Many communities are struggling now, whether that's on account of economic uncertainty or the ever-increasing threat of the coronavirus, as we see the number of confirmed cases continue to rise. But most Americans say they feel optimistic about the potential for recovery in the long term, and nearly 1 in 5 believe their community will emerge stronger than ever. That is according to a new national survey conducted by Public Agenda, USA Today, and Ipsos. The survey also finds some surprising agreement across partisan lines about what people feel is the best path forward. Illinois Newsroom health reporter Christine Herman filed a story on these findings, and she joins us now. Christine, welcome back to The 21st. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks, Brian.
So let's start with the big takeaways from this survey. What were those?
Right. So as you mentioned, most people are feeling pretty optimistic. The majority of people feel like even though their communities are going to suffer in the short term, that in the long term, they will recover. The reason may be because of what many people are seeing happen right now. So here's what Trina DeSembly in Toledo, Ohio told me.
I think all communities are going to be stronger because of this, because people are watching for other people, especially the elderly.
So Trina was talking about how just she's feeling like people in her neighborhood are talking to each other more often than they were before. They're contacting friends and family more than usual, and that's certainly something the survey found. And, you know, she's among the 20% of people who feel like their communities will emerge even stronger than before because of these types of things they're seeing happen. There's also a lot of evidence that people are, you know, wanting to help, whether they're helping already or planning to help others, whether it's other people or organizations by donating money, supplies, and time. These sorts of things have a lot of people these days feeling optimistic despite how challenging this time is.
And I think one of the purposes behind this survey effort is to try and look for common ground, right, among communities and people who maybe would not normally be on the same page politically. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So I spoke with Nova Powell. He's 77. He lives in a tiny town in Texas called Pettibone. It's in a rural part of the state, very conservative. And he told me that when his local grocery store ran out of distilled water, like many stores have in the recent past, he explained to them why he really needed it to operate a medical device that his wife needs when she sleeps.
They went totally out of their supply chain themselves and got a case of Ozarka distilled water and kept it aside for me. That's the kind of people that are here. And their politics are very far removed from mine. They're very pro-Trump and ultra-conservative and so forth. And they know that I'm not. But that doesn't matter to them. And it doesn't matter to me that they are.
I understand another major point of agreement across party lines, or at least consensus, is this idea that the federal government should be taking an active role in fighting COVID-19. What are we seeing in the data that speaks to that point?
Right. So the data shows that more than 90% of people say the federal government should do things such as provide free widespread testing. That's across party lines. Also, between 60 and 80% of both Republicans and Democrats feel the government should mandate manufacturers to create supplies that are needed at this time, mandate pharmaceutical companies to help with the development of treatments and vaccines. And there's also broad support for mandatory quarantine for people returning from high-risk areas. And, you know, one of the things that the people who conducted the poll, the one who I spoke with, David Schleifer, he's the director of research with Public Agenda, he said he was really surprised when he saw that nearly half of all Americans say that even domestic flights should be grounded right now. And we're seeing a lot of agreement on these points, which, you know, maybe we might not have expected to see that level of agreement prior to this type of crisis.
What about this? You know, we have seen some dissension about the amount of business shutdowns, and particularly in the southern part of the state where there haven't been as many confirmed cases, at least, you know, known and confirmed cases. I want to emphasize that yet, where people say, do we need, you know, this level of staying in place that is happening in statewide because of the governor's orders. So I wonder, what do people think about the idea of providing support to businesses and individuals who have been hurt by these stay-at-home orders and these layoffs that have resulted from that? I mean, there's record unemployment. Millions of people have lost their jobs across the country, and a lot of people are struggling financially.
Right. So what the survey found is that more than three quarters of Americans, this is people across party lines, feel that the federal government right now should provide businesses with things like no-interest loans and also give cash payments directly to those who need it throughout this crisis time. The survey also asked, interestingly, you know, whether people support paid sick leave legislation. Here, let's listen to what David Schleifer, director of research at Public Agenda, had to say discussing that point.
You have 70% of Republicans and 88% of Democrats who favor the federal government passing paid sick leave legislation, which I think is pretty interesting. And I don't think we would have seen that if we weren't in the situation that we're in.
That was David Schleifer from Public Agenda. He spoke with reporter Christine Herman about the results of a new national survey exploring people's views on the COVID-19 pandemic. Christine is here with us now on the 21st to help us learn more about this survey. Christine, the survey also found widespread agreement that the U.S. should not be too quick to return to normal life, right?
Yes. So this was one of the other significant findings from this data. 9 out of 10 Democrats and 81% of Republicans say they believe the nation should go slow in rebooting the economy to prevent the spread of COVID-19 and to help save lives. So we're seeing people on all sides of the political spectrum also say that the federal government's main priority right now should be preventing the spread of the virus. That's 80% of Democrats and 64% of Republicans who feel that. It is important to note, this is something David Schleifer shared with me from Public Agenda. They're the ones who conducted this poll. There's a small but significant minority, about 20% of people, who feel the government's main priority right now should be to protect the economy and to avoid a recession. So I spoke with Jean Vo. She's a Republican in Mobile, Alabama, to learn why she feels this way.
I mean, I understand they're trying to prevent deaths, but there are other long-term ways that people's lives can be affected, even if they're never touched by the virus themselves. I mean, financial problems can destroy marriages very easily. So if this drags on for months, people lose their homes, families are split up, and it's going to be bad. So I really don't know that it's the right thing to do to completely shut down most of the economy to save lives.
And there's also, sort of in that same vein, I understand, a partisan split over whether the federal government is doing a good job handling this crisis.
That's right, Brian. And, you know, perhaps not surprising, you know, Republicans are more than twice as likely as Democrats right now to feel like the government is doing all it can to address this crisis. So there is that partisan split we're seeing, despite seeing a lot of agreement on, you know, certain other areas and certain specifics regarding legislation and, you know, different efforts that people feel should be made right now.
So many of the people who participated in this survey were already struggling with economic uncertainty. I understand you spoke with 25-year-old Matthew Mullins in Grand Forks, North Dakota. Tell us about his situation.
Yeah, so Matthew, he told me he had just been laid off at a factory. He had a job at a factory that processes potato products. And, you know, he told me one of his big concerns right now, obviously, is how is he going to make his rent? How is he going to pay his bills? You know, he's having conversations with his landlord, as probably many people are right now, about, you know, like, will there be a grace period until, you know, maybe the stimulus money comes in or I'm able to find a way to pay? You know, and also he told me he has roommates who still work at that factory. And he said, you know, they feel lucky to have their jobs, but, you know, he's worried about their health and safety because it's a high traffic place. And, you know, to that point we were discussing earlier about paid sick leave, you know, he was saying the workers there don't have it. And he says the problem with that is that it incentivizes people to work through their illnesses, and that really puts everyone at risk.
Very shortly before this all began, we had a coworker with the flu who very openly spoke about having it, but wasn't willing to go home despite our protests.
And, you know, you can empathize with that, right? Because for someone who, for whom, you know, if I don't work, I don't get paid, that's a very challenging situation to be in. And now that the nation is dealing with this threat of COVID-19, it seems there's more support now for addressing this particular economic issue of paid sick leave, because this can very quickly become a public health issue.
Can you tell us also about Rick Liske in Toledo, Ohio? This is someone who's eagerly awaiting the money from the federal stimulus package because he has also been laid off from his job.
Yeah, that's right, Brian. Rick is 46. He told me he spent most of his life in the restaurant business, which we know is hurting everywhere right now. And he told me he recently lost his job as a sous chef at a local restaurant. And before COVID-19, he was saying if you lost your job, you could pretty easily find another one at a restaurant, at a, you know, another restaurant, because there were so many, but just not anymore. No one's hiring. So, you know, another thing we talked about was, you know, he told me that as a gay man, having restaurants and bars closed right now is really like a double whammy for him, because not only did he lose his job, but he's also lost that in-person connection that he had to the LGBTQ community.
Being a small community like we're in, you know, it's just not a bar. It's more of a community type deal, you know. It's where people go for togetherness, and then, you know, it's kind of like being on Cheers, where you want to go where everybody knows your name. So, you know, a lot of people feel isolated, you know, with that being gone and just all of a sudden ripped away from them.
So there's just a lot of people who are really struggling. I think that's really important to acknowledge that, you know, this survey found that most people, hold on, give me one second. This survey found that the majority of people actually don't perceive the threat of COVID-19 is significant for them personally. But, you know, still, there are still so many people like Rick, so many people like Matthew, who this has been devastating, and the uncertainty of the future is very, very scary for them.
So what does the data show about people's perceptions about how significant of a threat COVID-19 is to them and their communities?
So let's start with what the data shows about people's perceptions about the threats to the global economy and the U.S. more broadly. It's roughly three quarters of people, you know, so this is obviously across party lines, who feel this is this poses a real threat, as well as to the stock market. When you get down to the community level and the personal level is where those numbers drop off. So less than half of people say that they feel that COVID-19 poses a threat to their communities. And, you know, just over a third overall say they feel threatened by it personally. So that's a little bit interesting that people are perceiving this as a real threat, perhaps because there's so many stories we hear on the news and, you know, we're hearing about this, you know, 24/7 in the news cycle. But still, for people personally, there's still only, you know, roughly a third of people who are feeling this is a threat to me.
Yeah, I wonder personally if the lack of testing plays into that, right? Because we just don't know how widespread the disease is, particularly in some downstate communities where there's just been so little testing.
Right. And that's an interesting question. And you know, the data didn't break it down by age. You know, I would be curious to know, how does it break down, you know, for people who are elderly versus people who are younger? And, you know, for people in different geographic regions as well. Obviously, in some of the hotspots, this might be perceived as a bigger threat than in some parts of the country where they're not really seeing a huge spike in cases, at least, you know, not yet.
Yeah, and like you said, if you're young and you keep hearing the message that this mostly afflicts, or at least seriously afflicts older people more severely than younger people, that probably plays into your thinking as well.
Right.
So what other actions are people saying they want to see the federal government taking right now?
What the survey asked about is whether people feel the U.S. government should take certain actions to contain the spread of the coronavirus. So, you know, we already discussed this whole idea of mandatory quarantines and widespread testing. But there's also pretty broad support for temporarily stopping immigration from high-risk countries. So not just travel, but immigration, as well as canceling all large-scale events, you know, which obviously we're already seeing happen pretty much everywhere now. And imposing mandatory quarantines in certain spots of the country where there are major outbreaks, you know, more than 80% of people say they support those types of efforts. And then as well as, you know, more than 70% of people say ground all international flights. And this, you know, we hear about the shortage of surgical masks and protective gear. You know, 68% of people say that the federal government should be providing surgical masks for people in states with reported cases. So more support from the federal level for the states that are really dealing with outbreaks right now.
So bottom line here, what are your big takeaways from all of this reporting you've done on this survey?
So the data suggests that the COVID-19 pandemic, despite all of the difficulty it's causing right now, all the hardship, it's also unifying the way it's also unifying the nation in ways that, you know, maybe seemed inconceivable just a few weeks ago. There's support for certain types of legislation broadly that we maybe haven't seen in the past at that level. And, you know, I think the encouraging part for me and probably for many others hearing this right now is that there are a lot of people who are taking action to come together to try to support each other. And there's also pretty broad agreement that we can't be impatient when we're trying to move past the situation and get back to life as usual, to the way things once were. We need to move slowly to reboot the economy. There's pretty wide support for that, despite all of the challenges that are being created during this time.
Christine Herman is a reporter with WILL and Illinois Newsroom. She produced this story in partnership with Side Effects Public Media and America Amplified, a national public media collaboration focused on community engagement reporting. Christine, thanks so much for being here and sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you, Brian.
Coming up after the break, gyms and other fitness centers may be closed, but authorities say it's still okay to be outside, at least at an appropriate social distance. That has some people taking up running. We'll talk to a couple of experts just ahead, and we want to hear your story. Have you been putting in miles since the stay-at-home order? Give us a call at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Or tweet us at 21st Show. That's 21ST Show. That's all coming up on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Because of the coronavirus, gyms are closed and fitness classes have had to go virtual. But one of the activities that is not prohibited is a run outside, provided you maintain at least 6 feet of distance between you and other people on the path. And people who run will tell you that it's also a great form of stress relief. We've asked runners in Illinois to share some of their thoughts with us about running in the time of coronavirus.
Hi, I'm Michael Hyman. I'm a physics PhD student at the University of Illinois. I ran a half marathon today in honor of the Lincoln Presidential that was supposed to happen in Springfield. I got running about a year and 8 months ago, primarily for my health. Yet, as it happens, I got involved with Second Wind Running Club about 9 months later and would describe myself now as a runner whose only goal is to get better. Thankfully now, even in these tumultuous times, I'm still in touch with my friends that I met in Second Wind, and despite not being able to run in person and go to big races, we still support each other, talk about our solo runs, and check in on each other's mental health. I have running to thank for introducing me to this community and great friends that really want nothing but the best for each other.
You can join the conversation as well. Give us a call, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. If you're a runner or maybe thinking about getting into it, you can also tweet us at 21ST Show, 21st Show. We're joined now by two expert runners from Illinois. Aisha Pratt is a native of Moline, a middle distance runner and an Olympic athlete. She also ran at Illinois State University. Aisha, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thanks, Brian.
And also with us now is Tyler Pence. He coaches cross country at the University of Illinois Springfield and competed in the men's Olympic marathon trials back in February. Tyler, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for having me.
So both of you are expert runners, I think it's fair to say, and you run different distances. For people who might just be starting out running, what tips can you offer for getting into this activity? And Aisha, let's start with you.
Yeah, sure. I think it can be intimidating to start running. Running is hard and it takes practice. So my tip would be to start slow. Go out for a walk and add in, you know, a minute on, couple minutes off of jogging and walking. And slowly your minutes will become multiple minutes, can become 10 minutes, and you're out for a 30-minute run before you know it. But start slow.
And what about you, Tyler? Same question.
Yeah, I mean, going off of what she said, I think it's just getting out the door. I think whether you are a beginner or even an elite, getting out of the door is one of the hardest things as a runner. So I think just starting there and getting outside, whether you're walking or running. Secondly, I think just be consistent. It's easy to get out the door when you want to, but if you really want to grow as a runner, then you have to be consistent and do it daily, even on the days that you don't want to. So, yeah, those would be my two suggestions for sure.
And Tyler, what are some common mistakes that first-time or early runners make?
Kind of going off of what she said was they do go too fast too early. It's being impatient and not understanding that it is a long-term process. You know, if you look at any runner who has been doing it for a long time, it's taken them quite a while to get where they're at. And it's hard to think long-term, but you have to. In the running, you're not just going to become this good runner overnight. You have to just be patient and listen to your body. And that's another thing too, is injury prevention, is you have to listen to your body and understand that when you need to tone it back and when you can press forward a little bit. So it's just understanding kind of that fine line between doing too much or too little.
I love that line, listen to your body. But what if your body's telling you to stay on the couch? I guess there are limits to that advice.
Yeah, there's limits to that.
All right, Aisha, what is it that first drew you into running? Do you remember did you have to start slow as you're describing? What was that process like for you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely had to start slow. I was more of a sprinter and cheerleader early in high school, and I had a friend who convinced me to go out for cross country, and I'd never gone jogging before. That wasn't a thing. My family was not a running family, and it took me a while to get into it. My parents came to my first cross country race. They told me this after, of course, but they weren't sure that I could run 3 miles straight to even contest the race. But I could, and it took time. So yeah, and it still takes time to improve. And to Tyler's point, I ran almost 3,000 miles last year to get 1 second faster in the mile. So, it takes time, and that's okay.
Oh my gosh. I don't even know what to do with that information. 3,000 miles. Tyler, same question to you. What about you? How did you get into running?
Mine kind of started, I was doing a lot of other sports during middle school, whether it was soccer, baseball, all of the kind of the main sports. And, running was always my favorite part of practices, which is crazy. Everybody else hated that section, and I always loved when it came to running at practice. So my mom kind of talked me into going out for cross country in sixth grade, and that's kind of all she wrote. Once I started, I just loved it. And I kind of hung up all the other sports at that point and knew going into high school that's the approach I wanted to take. And ever since, that's kind of been my main sport.
So Aisha, you mentioned, working so hard to just improve a little bit at this, elite athlete level where you are now. But do you still find running to be a form of stress relief for you? Or is it something
Absolutely.
Else?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, no. I mean, it's certainly my job, but there is so much joy and peace for me in going outside and being with my thoughts and being in nature. And for me, I find that the time I have where I can put technology down and just be is really rare these days. And I think running is that outlet for me. It's where I solved all the problems and the noise in my mind and where I find all the clarity and stress relief. So yeah, I think it's still such a beautiful thing that I'm really passionate about, just the way my body feels and the way I walk away. You never are mad after the fact for going for a run. I seem to always walk away better.
Yeah. And Tyler, what about you? You're also a professional in this world. Do you get any joy and stress relief, or is this still a job?
Absolutely. She's spot on with everything she said. I mean, putting your phone down, stepping away from the TV and anything that's going on in your life and just getting out the door and running. For me, that's my time to think about my day, think about anything that's, maybe going wrong in my life at the time. And I've heard a lot of people, they reference it too. Like that's my church. That's me going out and, you just come back and you leave feeling so much better. And that's definitely the way it is for me. If I'm ever having a tough day, I'll go out in the door and just get a light shakeout run. And I come back just refreshed and ready to get back into things. So I think for anybody, while during the run, you may not feel great. I'll tell you afterwards, you always feel so good about it and just feel refreshed. So that's my biggest suggestion too.
So our listener, Michael, who we heard from at the top of the segment, he mentioned that he ran a race or at least the length of a race that had been canceled. And both of you had a big running event postponed, the Olympics. People might have heard about that. Aisha, I want to start with you. Could you tell us what event you had been hoping to compete in and how you're feeling about the postponement?
Yeah, it's a big deal. I was hoping to contest the 1500 meters, and it's tough. I mean, since I graduated college in 2012, my life has been sort of lived and planned around these 4-year segments. Every Olympic year is sort of the shining beacon for track and field, and it's tough. It's sort of shifts my life's timeline back a year. And that may seem dramatic, but this is my passion and everything that I am training for and living for. This is sort of like my life's work. So pushing back a year means, you know, I'm 30, and it means that I'm in my prime and I'm looking toward one more year to extend the life of my career. And having things be put on hold, it's kind of a dramatic ripple in my life, but I believe it's absolutely the right decision. It just means that, you know, I'm living in a 5-year cycle instead of a 4-year cycle this time around.
But it is something, I mean, and that's true. Runners, it's not like some sports where, you know, once you hit age 24, it's all downhill from there. Runners do compete into their, well into their 30s, right? And beyond even sometimes.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. The sort of peak age for a lot of women particularly is sort of 28 to 33. So I'm kind of right in the middle of that. So you do see athletes, especially moving up to the marathon, competing well into their late 30s and early 40s and being phenomenal there. But for my particular niche, I'm sort of in the thick of it now.
And Tyler, I understand you were training for the men's Olympic marathon trials, mm-hmm. which took place back in yep. February, but you were sidelined. Yep. Are you already looking yep. ahead to the next Olympic Games?
Yeah, you know, I don't think that long a term. You know, I definitely want to run the trials again in 2024 and give it another shot. However, I think right now it's just focusing on what I'm going to do for the next year. While, like kind of like she said, it is 4-year cycles that you're really thinking about. You know, I try to not think too long term and just go year by year. I want to run some of the majors, so Chicago, Boston, New York, and just get more experience under my belt. Going off of what she said, you know, the peak for marathoners, you know, it's usually between 30 and 40. And, you know, this year we had a guy who was 43 and ended up making a team for the marathon. So, you know, I'm only 26 years old. I have a lot of time left as far as the marathon goes. So right now, my biggest focus is just experience and growing in that. And obviously, it's hard right now with all these people who are going through the changes as far as moving the Olympics back. And, you know, those who just made the team for the marathon, it's obviously a tough situation for them as it's going to be bumped back. But you know what? Everybody's in a situation where you kind of have to just control what you can control. And obviously, right now, we're in a situation where there's a lot of things that aren't in our control. And it's just keeping that positive mindset and doing what you can.
Mm-hmm. So we got a call from Jim in Rockford at 800-222-9455. Didn't want to come on air, but just mentioned that he's a cyclist. He was a little concerned that we mentioned the 6 feet of social distance. And if you're running and breathing heavily, if there's a wind, maybe that's not enough distance. So in just about 2 minutes we have remaining, Aisha, you're, I understand, part of a group of runners training in Boulder. How are you training right now? What are you doing to keep yourself safe as you continue running?
Yeah, so I'm training by myself. Everybody in my training group has decided to split up and train by themselves. And just this morning, I started using a buff sort of fabric covering that when I am approaching someone else on the trail, I cover my nose and mouth, and then I take the buff off after I've cleared sort of a longer distance than 6 feet away. And that seems to be helping, and others in Boulder are doing the same.
And Tyler, what about you? How is the team training at UIS?
Well, they're all alone at home. You know, we cannot be on campus. I cannot meet with them. So everybody is back at home and training by themselves. So, you know, we're really not running into the issue of anybody running together or too close together. So and for my own training as well, I've been training alone here in Springfield. And again, when I'm out on the trail, I just try to keep as far away from others as possible. And, you know, just make sure I'm keeping myself and everyone else safe for sure.
So only about a minute left. Many people, I imagine, are training ahead of an event. And as we've mentioned, a lot of events have been canceled. I imagine if you're working up for that, that can be really disappointing. Aisha, do you have any advice for runners who feel that for how to persevere?
Yeah, I mean, to Tyler's point, control what you can control, stay positive, and connect with people virtually. take your run, take your race virtual and connect with others who are doing the same thing. We're all in the same boat.
Tyler, same thing to you, about 20 seconds before we're done. Do you have any advice for keeping your spirits up?
Yeah, it's kind of like what we talked about earlier. You know, running, it's a year-long process of just getting better and better and better, and you got to, you know, keep putting the work. I keep telling my athletes that what they do this spring is the foundation for what they do next fall. So you got to think long-term. You can't just take this time off now and expect to do big things here in 6 months. You know, it all builds on each other and builds on itself.
Okay. That is Tyler Pence, men's marathoner and coach of the University of Illinois Springfield cross country team. We also spoke with Aisha Pratt, a middle distance runner and Olympic athlete originally from Moline, Illinois. Thank you both so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thanks for having me.
And we're also going to tweet out some virtual races on our Twitter account. That's at 21st Show, at 21st Show. Our program is produced by Libby Foster and Anna Casey. Eunice Alpison is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Special thank you to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Brian Mackey. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Talk to you tomorrow. Thanks for listening.